This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome to the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any breaking updates and discussions on this case as we have them. Alex Murdaugh and the video that was released of his interrogation with police in the, I believe it was a police cruiser or it was some sort of vehicle, the night of the murders. Have you had a chance to see this yet? We've posted the audio for you here on the podcast. If you've not listened to it yet, go back and take a listen to that before listening to the rest of this episode, because it puts it into a lot more of a perspective, if you will. This video was shown in court last week during the trial. And even since that time, today, as the trial has continued on, more audio, more video of candid conversations being released of Alex Murdaugh. But I want to talk specifically about this one, because this is one of the first ones that we've gotten to see as the public. And when someone is in a state of shock, in a state of trauma, they act differently. Everybody acts differently. And it's not always what one would predict. So going into this, I'm not saying, oh my gosh, he just saw his wife was murdered and his son's brains were literally out there in the room and he just saw all this. So why is he acting like this? And by like this, I don't even know what I mean, because there's moments of utter desperation and sadness in him and then seems to snap back to just kind of normal conversation. Again, I've never been in a position, and I pray to God I never will be, of having seen my spouse and child murdered. I don't know how I would act. I guess personally, if I were to take a guess at it, I don't know that I'd be able to have any sort of conversation that makes any conceivable sense at that moment in time. Alex Murdaugh has been around the criminal justice system for all of his life. Maybe he has a little more discipline, if you will, to get through some of those things. I don't know, but it was a very weird video to watch and to try and get a sense of what is this person going through right now? Because depending on the time marker you're watching, it's a very different individual. Joining me to discuss what is in that video, what we're looking at, is an expert in that that field, Siobhan Scott, a psychotherapist and author. Siobhan, you've seen the video. From your standpoint and your expertise, tell me what you're feeling from it.
Yeah, you know, it's a really disturbing footage, of course. And one of the things that has been studied quite a bit is, can we tell when people are lying when you're talking with them and they're relaying a story of what happened? We've all got theories, you know. Oh, well, he was crying, but he didn't shed tears, actually, you know, and he changed his story and he said this and then he said that. It's really hard to know just from the things people say how truthful they're being. Clearly, he was upset. Mm-hmm. Was he upset enough? I think if I were in that situation and I came upon my loved one's body, I would have been more upset than he seemed to be. However, there are times when people have more of a dissociative response in times of horror, and they shut down and they don't act very upset at all, you know? So it can be, the response can be erratic, inconsistent. It can seem a bit counterintuitive at times. And I think the video is interesting. It's important. I will watch it probably again and go through and take notes. But I don't think it gives us any kind of a definitive picture on what really happened. I think we're going to have to look at all the other evidence that's presented in court. They were making a point about, he said he had checked the pulse of his son. And then, you know, it came up later, well, how did he check the pulse? Because the son's hands were under the body. Mm-hmm. He hadn't turned the body over, even though he said, oh, well, I tried to turn him or whatever. There seemed to be a lot of confusion around what he said. And could he have checked the pulse and the neck? Apparently that could not have, he could not have accessed that area either. So people were trying to say he's spinning a story. I think because he's proven himself to be such a spinner of tall tales, that everyone is scrutinizing very closely his version of the events. And I think that's appropriate in this case. He's certainly a man who is creative, if you want to put the most benign spin on it, creative in his storytelling. And he's not proven himself to be invested in telling the truth. So this is, again, going to be a fascinating trial, and I'm very eager to see what evidence is presented.
Yeah, it's been interesting watching some of that video and some of the reaction, and it's hard to truly gauge any of it. Just from the perspective of, yes, there's a trauma that just occurred there. Whether or not he did it, I think there would be some level of strange behavior from if you are the murderer or if you just came across your wife and son dead. So, I mean, it's easy in some ways to judge and go, well, look how quickly he goes from really like flat out crying, although there were no visible tears, it to suddenly, oh yeah, that's my son's friend. He's down the road. He's a good guy. And it was a lot of really back and forth quickly, but again, yes, deflecting. Many people handle trauma in very different ways, and it doesn't necessarily make them a murderer per se. But it may, you know, it's like, it's hard to judge unless you're in that situation.
I think in that case, we're really going to need the evidence, you know, to make the call. And I'm very curious to hear the state's case. We love, of course, the weapon with the DNA on it, you know, the knife sticking out of the body with DNA. That makes it nice and clear. This is much more murky. And how much of a leap is it for this guy to commit murder? You know, will a man who steals from orphans and the disabled kill his own family? That's the big question here.
In a lot of ways, it doesn't seem a bridge too far, but murder is quite a difference. I would say, at least from a perspective out here, that's very different than stealing from orphans. I mean, it's horrible, but is it? I mean, in psychology, when people keep moving the goalposts and you kind of keep going, well, I did this, so maybe I can do that. And you know, sometimes it's, you know, petty theft too. Oh my gosh, now you're eventually stealing a car or something. Is it really that crazy to say that, well, he's pushed it this far. Look how much he's done.
It is not crazy to ask that question.
No.
It's an appropriate question because this guy, you know, a successful psychopath can look like a very charming person who's very a fine, upstanding citizen, right? And sometimes the most dangerous predators look like fine, upstanding citizens. Sadists can present of the exact opposite of what they really are. And so we don't know, but we do know that there was a pattern in this county of institutionalized psychopathy, you know, with the list of financial crimes and again, stealing from the vulnerable. He weaponized this appearance of normalcy, you know, wealth and power enabled the criminality. And so if you don't have much of a conscience and you're willing to steal $4 million from your housekeeper's stepchildren who are left penniless upon her death, what else might you do? And so it's would be a leap, but we don't really know. I don't know. I would love to have the guys full, honest, complete history. Has he been violent in the past? We don't know that. You know, are there other things that were just never reported? And again, you've got the substance abuse piece thrown in here. How much of this is a con? we don't know what happened with all these millions of dollars that were embezzled and taken fraudulently from people. There doesn't seem to be an explanation for that at this point, other than, oh, well, he had a drug problem. Well, addiction makes people erratic, impulsive, and stupid too, when they're under the influence. And I don't see a mastermind criminal here, but I do see someone with very strong psychopathic tendencies who was erratic, impulsive, and stupid. That 911 call where he hired his cousin to pretend to try to murder him or whatever that was, mm-hmm. that's in the erratic, impulsive, and stupid category, you know? But clearly the guy likes to spin false narratives, and it's clearly a very confusing, strange, but horrendous case that will be a very interesting trial.
Spinning false narratives, it's essentially what their family has done for generations.
Exactly.
And my question about that, obviously there's certainly a conditioning aspect of that where it just kind of comes naturally as this is who raises who. At some point, though, is it also genetic? Is it somehow, you know, after you've done this for so long and then you have children, they have children, it keeps going down. Does this become more ingrained into one's brain beyond just conditioning in life, but more so this is how the future generation's brains are operating after you go so many deep in with people, so many generations?
Yeah. Well, at least 50% of personality is heritable, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you combine the genetics of this family, this wealthy, powerful family that have institutionalized psychopathy in this small county, and the way that they've raised their kids for years. Mm-hmm. Guns are clearly a big part of the family. And we know that in any kind of domestic violence situation, if there's a gun in the house, the potential for murder goes up 500%, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's just a very interesting group of people, and kind of just this dark dynasty in a small southern town saga. So,
yeah, I mean, it makes me wonder about that, because I just did a piece yesterday about the history going all the way back to the 1920s and trains. They have a long history with trains and death. And just looking at this piece by piece, generation by generation, and it kind of made me wonder, you know, at some point they're spinning stories, but I think some of the older generation knew the difference between wrong and right, but
right.
This was their job and they knew where the actual line was. By the time it got to Alec, and this was so ingrained, you know, by inheritance genetically, is that line no longer there of right and wrong? And he has the same mind and legal mind as his, you know, grandfather, great grandfather, father, all that. But that line maybe wasn't there. Do you see that ever in generations of people where, you know, there is a level of psychopathy that goes on, but at some point, as they continue to breed, for lack of a better term, it becomes more and more reckless from generation to generation?
Yeah, you certainly do see it in family, you know, the mafia kind of families, where, you know, when I was first working in California with a forensic population, I had multi-generational families that had been involved in the drug cartels. And, you know, the psychopathy was thick. I mean, it was just from murder to all kinds of crimes that were just endemic in the culture. And how much of that is genetic and how much of that is the environment? We can never completely sort that out on a case-by-case basis. You know, it's always different, but we do know that they go together.
Siobhan Scott, always a pleasure. Thank you for giving us your insight into this absolutely bizarre case. So many layers of the onion as we continue to peel them back. Be sure to press subscribe, whatever platform it is you're listening to us on, so you don't miss any breaking updates and discussions. If you're going through Apple Podcasts and you want a commercial-free experience of it, it is there for you. You can even try it for 3 days free. You'll get access to all of the shows that we put together under the True Crime Family umbrella, if you will. Hidden Killers, True Crime Today, The Trial of Alec Murdaugh, Finding Anna, and there's still more to come. All of it ad-free when you subscribe right there. We do appreciate that. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.